The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Nikki Hayes, currently working with East Coast, probably most famously recognised from her long period at 2FM. She's done an extended interview with Niamh Horan in the Sunday Independent this weekend. And the interview begins, Jerry Ryan used to tell her, "You've got this, kiddo." But somewhere along the way, Nikki Hayes' life started to crumble. Now she can clearly see where it began. And Nikki is with us this morning. Nikki, in reading this, because I had no idea of what you had been through, the last few years have been an absolute horror.
Oh, yeah. Absolute hell. To be honest with you, I am coming out the other end of it, but I had a severe trauma as a result of it. It was really harrowing, yeah.
So starting when you were working in 2FM and were, I mean, one of the sort of the backbones of the station at that period, how did that come to a conclusion and what happened then?
Okay, so I used to work under John Clark during his period as head of 2FM, and then new management came on board, and when they did, they decided they wanted to take the station in a different direction, and basically did a sweep. Three of us were actually let go at the same time. So it wasn't that we did anything wrong, that the listenership figures were wrong, nothing like that. It was just new management in, let's, you know, try something new.
Which is so common in radio.
It is. But it was the first time it happened to me. So I think I was just gutted. And I kind of came from an old school mentality that my family, like my granddad and stuff, thought you're in RTE, job for life, you know, and it didn't turn out that way. So
you reacted how?
I was extremely depressed. I probably around that time would have taken to the bottle quite a lot as well. Sat in, didn't get dressed. I got a phone call actually a month afterwards. So I finished up around the end of August, and about late September, I got a phone call from Louis Walsh, and he was like, "Get up, get dressed. I've got a new band. They're putting on a showcase tonight. Come up. I'll introduce you to a few people." He introduced me to the head of 104 and a couple other people. But anyway, as a result of that and getting out of my bed and pulling myself out of that, I ended up then back on Spin 103.8 a month later. So, yeah, but it was for him.
And what about the relationship then with drink? At what point did you begin to think this is getting unhealthy?
When I look back now, because I've gone through treatment, I can see it was always there and always an issue and always poking its head up. So anytime anything was bad, it was my crutch. It was what I ran to.
From being a kid?
Yeah, well, I started drinking when I was 11. So I have an 11-year-old daughter now. So that's really scary because I started drinking when I was 11. And when I was in my teens, it was like I was the one at the party that everyone, she's a bit mad, you know, she's a bit wild. I would drink for the feeling, not the taste. It was exactly the effect. I wanted to be drunk. And when I drank, I felt better about myself because I was always a bit awkward. So I felt like then I kind of fitted in, you know.
So when did you think this is getting out of hand?
Well, I was told by family and friends like constantly throughout, but I think it really took a hold of me. I suppose during my 2FM days, it was pretty bad, but I was highly functioning, managed to hold down a job, a house, everything else. But when my marriage broke up then, I guess I kind of thought maybe, oh yeah, sure, I've nothing to lose now. I did have stuff to lose. I had a daughter, but I just got into a really, really deep thing with my addiction, and the addiction took hold of me and it brought me to a really, really dark place. I ended up losing everything, my family, my friends, my house, my job. You know, eventually I was working for Classic Hits at the time. They, you know, tried their best to work with me, but there came a point where it was like, we can't do anything for you anymore. So, you know, I lost everything, absolutely everything. And that was 5 years ago.
Because what, was it that you were hungover the next day struggling to do the show, or was it drinking during the mornings, or at what point, how bad did it get at that stage?
It would have been drinking till like 7-8 in the morning, and then at the time we were in COVID, so I was broadcasting from home, so I would be recording maybe 11 o'clock in the morning, so clearly the effects were still there. And I remember Andy the PD at the time saying to me, you know, are you all right, love, you know, because you could hear I sounded quite sleepy, and I blamed it on sleep medication that I was on, which it wasn't, you know. It probably was a combination of both, but I was always covering it. There was always justification and there was always a reason why it wasn't the drink, even though somewhere deep down I knew it was eating away at me.
Did you at the time?
I must have, because when I look back, it was carnage. My whole life was just chaos. I mean, even the good times, like I say, I was highly functioning, so I could hold things together, but I was an alcoholic more or less from my first drink. definitely. You know, it was, and my father was an alcoholic, so it's in the genes. So I should have been more aware of that. And it's, you know, one thing I'm going to be very aware of as a mother as well going forward is that this is in the family. So, yeah, I mean, when I look back, and obviously I've gone through 16 and a half months of treatment with Tiglin, and it's taught me that it was there from the very start. This is not something that just crept on me because of a bad time. I am an addict, and that's just the way it is.
So you would now look back at and reinterpret a lot of your life through that lens.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, now I have the knowledge and the insight, and I've been stripped back bare. I realise that I probably was born an addict. Yeah, and you know, I know my choice of work probably enabled it slightly, because you know yourself, we get invited to the opening of an envelope and free bar, and you know, I was on press trips over and back to the UK, and there was an awful lot of that. It certainly didn't cause it because I wasn't on the radio when I was 11, but it definitely probably enabled it. Yeah.
Do you remember your dad's addiction?
The only thing I can remember, I was saying to Niamh in the interview, was I remember being about 3 or 4, and where I lived in Bray, we were around the corner from where we lived, and my dad fell and he had quite a deep gash on his knee, and he asked me to go into one of the neighbours and ask them to drive us home. And I remember, I know I was quite young, very young at the time, but I remember thinking, why can't we just walk? You know, he couldn't actually make it around that corner, and that's the only memory I have. Apart from that, I idolised my father. I had him on a pedestal all my life, and him, me, which kind of, you know, he excused a lot of my behaviour because he felt, because he was absent for the first 4 years of my life, that he had to almost overcompensate for it afterwards. So if I did something wrong, it was never wrong, you know. So, you know, there was an awful lot of that as well. So.
And do you think he saw bits of his own struggles in you? Do you think he recognised any of the difficulties you had with
I would
alcohol?
Say he did, because he also suffered with some mental health issues, as did I. So I'd say he probably did see an awful lot. Unfortunately, like now, actually from last week, my dad was dead 18 years. Still, I mean, the biggest loss of my life. I'd say he saw an awful lot of himself in me, yeah.
You said you lost everything. You lost family, friends, house. Often when people say that, it's metaphorical. You know, it's a way of saying it was a very difficult period. In your case, that is literal. You ended up effectively living on O'Connell Street.
I did, yeah. I ended up on the street. So when my house, I was privately renting, and when the lease ran out, I hadn't saved any money for a deposit for a new place. So I was hanging around with an extremely bad crowd at the time. Really, really bad. They brought me to very dark places, and they said I could stay with them. I was there a couple of weeks. It was a very volatile situation, and I had to leave in the middle of the night and found myself on the streets of Dublin. Didn't know what to do, where to do. I slept in the Penny's side entrance on Abbey Street. But my main place was Wolfetone Square behind Jervis Shopping Centre, because there were deliveries there at all times of the day and night. So I knew that I was never kind of going to be on my own. I found that spot, and it was also where the Simon community would send their outreach team. So if there was a chance that I could get an emergency bed, they would know I was there. So I kind of, that was my spot. But I was there for 3 months.
3 months?
Yeah.
What did you think about when you were there? How did you rationalise it? How did you explain it to yourself?
I just always remember a crowd coming out from the church nightclub, and they were full of life and they were laughing and joking. And I was lying there, and it was lashing rain, and I was cold and I was wet, and I felt like I smelled, and I just felt like a nobody. I mean, even now when I'm saying it to you, I can just feel myself getting emotional, because it was just like that moment where nobody can see you. Nobody wants to know you. You feel like dirt, and yeah, you just feel like nothing. It's like it was the lowest point in my life. And that was one of the nights that the Simon community actually came down to me, and they had no bed for me. So they just gave me another sleeping bag. So I had two wet sleeping bags on me on a park bench in Wolfetone Square. That was my lowest point.
Were you terrified?
I was some nights. I'm surprised in some ways that I wasn't attacked. I mean, I did have people who came over and tried to talk or got a little bit aggressive when they were drunk. But to be honest, it was other people on the street, other homeless people. There were some guys who slept around McDonald's and Penny's on Mary Street. And they used to kind of look out for me, and they'd send people around to me if they were coming, like with teas and coffees and stuff like that. So amazingly enough, there's a community there on the street, and they kind of look out for each other.
And did you think, how did I get here? Or is it such a miserable experience that survival through the day is all that you can focus on?
Yeah, it really is survival. I mean, you're literally going from soup run to soup run. For me, my family and friends, close friends, didn't know. I was too ashamed to tell them what had happened. As far as they were concerned, I was staying somewhere. They didn't know where because I'd lost contact with them. It was only in November that I broke down on the phone to my sister Anne in Australia, and I told her, or in America, she's in Florida, and I told her that the situation. She rang my sister Caroline, who is in Australia, and the two of them were shocked. The two of them got together and they started paying to put me up in tourist hostels. I stayed in the Abbey Court, in Abigail's, a couple of other like tourist hostels, and they kept me there until I got into Tiglin, which they pushed and pushed for. So,
but that was how they found out. You were on a phone call. You said, "I have been."
Yeah, I broke down. I was walking around. I used to do things during the day so I didn't have to walk around in the rain. So I was walking around the National Gallery, and I'm laughing because it's just the madness of it all. And Anne rang me, and I just said, you know, I'm on the street. She couldn't believe it. She was like, "What do you mean?" Explained it to her. She rang Caroline immediately. Caroline got on to me. She was like, "You have to go into Tiglin." She knew someone who had worked there before. She knew it was a tough program. It's 16 months. I ended up doing 16 and a half months. But she was like, "This is the only thing that's going to get you right." She said, "Until you admit that you're out of control and you're an addict, nothing is going to happen for you." And those words like ring true. And she was right, until I admitted it.
What age was your little girl at this point?
Farah would have been, so it was 5 years ago, she was seven, six and a half. She was actually six and a half at the time, yeah.
And presumably you would have had little chance to have any contact with her at that
stage. No, so she was living with her father at that stage. I did see her, but she was living with her father, who was an amazing dad, an amazing father. And she's an amazing girl. She's very resilient and she knows everything. She asks questions. She actually Googled me last year and found out about all the court proceedings and stuff like that. So, yeah, we're very honest and open with her, and she's great. And I'm back in her life. I'm very present, but she knows everything. And she's always told, if you have any questions, come talk to us.
You mentioned the court proceedings. The court proceedings was a case in respect of a charge of money laundering, which the judge, as I understand it, eventually dismissed on the grounds that you had been effectively, you were the victim in it as much as a perpetrator. The point at which you got involved in Tiglin, what's that first day like? Is it, you know, scales have fallen from my eyes, I'm starting the road to recovery, or is it total desperation and surrender?
Well, I was traumatized when I went down to British Bay to Tiglin to their residential. So I didn't, it's weird to say this with my profession, but I didn't talk for 5 months. It got to the point that Lara, who runs the centre down there, was like, you know, "Emer, I don't know if we're going to be able to work with you. You're not participating." You know, so just even like to communicate, I couldn't do it. I was on very heavy psychotic medication as well. So they weaned me off all that as well. And it was only literally after about 5 months that I started to talk and come out of myself. Then I started doing counselling and therapy, and it was when I went down to Greystones to aftercare with Tiglin, Brian and Kevin, I always sing their praises, the manager and my key worker, they brought me back to life. They took the broken, sober person and just breathed life back into me again, and they built me up, and I spent 7 months there in Greystones in aftercare. And I'm telling you, those two men, I owe an awful lot to. They put me back on the mark, and Brian actually was the one who got me back in my daughter's life.
How close do you think you came to not turning it around? Because being alcohol addicted, rough sleeping, and on antipsychotics as a combination, there aren't many who get that close to the edge and come back from it.
Well, to be honest with you, I was queuing up for something to eat in the Lighthouse on Pier Street one day. The light bulb went off. Oh, it's the same people who own Tiglin. I asked for an assessment. Edie Donoghue, who does the assessments there, she did my assessment for me, and she was like, she met me and she was like, "That girl is going to be dead. She is not streetwise. She doesn't have a clue. Someone's going to end up hurting her, or she's going to end up dead." She made sure 2 weeks later I was in Tiglin.
What was the process like then when you did begin to get weaned off the drugs, when you began to get weaned, when you began to get back into talking and communicating? What do you recall as the big steps in the rehab?
Well, there's huge therapeutic classes. You're taught, you know, about addiction, why it happens, where it happens, when it happens, and huge emphasis on relapse prevention, because nobody wants to go back there. You don't choose to be an addict. Why would you? It's miserable. And I certainly never want to revisit that part of my life again. I mean, I cry sometimes at night just at the thoughts of where I was and how close I came to death.
Now, as you then begin to rehab, you talk about getting back in your daughter's life, and you said about Farah asking all the questions. How do you handle that? And how do you explain to a young child what's happened and happening?
She, like I say, she's extremely resilient, and I'm very blessed that her father is an amazing father, because he has been open and honest with her about everything. And she may not fully understand what addiction is, but she knows mommy wasn't well. She knows that mommy had to go away and live with girls for a couple of months because I was in a women's rehabilitation. So she knows the basis. She also knows the reason that things were in the paper last year was because of my job. So she may not know the in-depth parts of it, but I'm very lucky in the fact that to co-parent with the great father. So
is that harder, the bit about the job? Because when you're beginning to get yourself back on your feet, you are Nikki Hayes off the radio, while at the same time I assume you want to not be. Let me just focus on myself and getting myself squared away. Is that difficult, squaring the two?
Yeah. I mean, the hardest part for me was I was still in treatment last year when I had to go in front of the judge in the CCJ, and I was chased up the road by news cameras, and literally chased up. One guy jumped over shrubbery to get to me, and that was horrific, horrific, because I was in the middle of treatment. I was trying to get myself back together. I wanted to be there for my daughter, my family, my friends. I wanted real life. And yet this shadow was still following me and running after me. So it was traumatic. I actually made the decision I was not going back to radio. It was like, no, you know, I've made the decision. I'm going to move on. I'm going to retrain. I'm going to do something else. But something just kept calling me. I know they say the bug of radio, but my heart was just like, I love this. I really love it. But I'm being cautious. I'm doing it at my own pace. And I'm very lucky with them in East Coast FM because they're letting me do it at my pace. I'm coming back slowly. I'm doing little bits here and there. I'm not throwing myself into the industry again. So, you know, I mean, when you think about it, I'm only a month and a half out of treatment. So it's still extremely fresh. I finished up on the 7th of April. So, you know, I'm still very fresh into the world and still navigating.
How long are you without a drink?
18 months and 1 week. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Talk to me then about how you are different, because you said about you realised that you had been an addict from a very young age and how you saw things with a different lens. To what extent do you think the rehab and the treatment has changed you or changed the way you think or treat life?
I appreciate things an awful lot more. Quality rather than quantity. I used to have loads of friends. They were not friends, but I used to think I had loads of friends. I now have 5 friends, and that's all I have. That's all I want. Audrey Paul and Ronan, Nicola, and, they're the ones that I keep close to me. Everybody else, I don't want to know. I'm probably a lot more cautious. I don't trust people very often, but my sobriety is everything to me, and nobody is ever going to rob me of my peace of mind, because I robbed me of that for long enough. And it's the most important thing. So I'm a lot more real. I cry a lot more. I'm more emotional. But what you see is what you get. Whereas before, there was a bit of the Nikki Emer thing where I was like two completely different people.
Emer being off air, Nikki being the on air persona.
Yeah.
Is sobriety difficult?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's every day at a time for a reason. Thank God, with thanks to Tiglin and my treatment there, I have not craved or wanted to go back using. I'm not saying it won't come there. Now I keep up my meetings. I go to AA. I've been to CA. So I make sure that I keep myself in the right recovery circles. But yeah, it is. It's every day one day at a time for a reason.
You talked about your dad treating you in a certain way, being maybe lenient or whatever it might be, because of not having been as present in the early years of your life. Do you carry any of that kind of guilt in relation to your own daughter? Do you feel now that you have making up to do, or do you just return to normal?
Oh gosh, no. I carry immense guilt. Even if I like think of her now, I feel like I'm going to start crying. She is the most important thing to me. I let her down in the most phenomenal, substantial way, and I will spend the rest of my life trying to make that up to her.
Text saying, Anton, I need to commend Nikki's bravery and strength to speak so publicly about her struggle. Wow, what a story. Nikki Hayes, such an iconic name, super DJ. Glad to hear you're back on track. And I'll probably be shot for doing it, because in theory you're a competitor. If people want to hear you, how can they hunt you down?
I'm presenting with East Coast FM at the moment in Wicklow. I'm doing a project for Commissioner Man, and at the weekends on East Coast as well.
It is brilliant. And congratulations on the 18 months and 1 week of sobriety, and long may it continue. And if you want to read more of what Nikki has to say, you can get it in the Sunday Independent, that interview with Niamh Horan. We'll be back after this break.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.